the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Mark Lewison is my guest. He is a renowned Beatles scholar and has written several Beatles books, including the indispensable The Complete Beatles Recording Sessions, the official story of the Abbey Road years. Now he has written The Beatles, All These Years, Volume 1, Tune In, which covers the birth of the Beatles in a detail as never before. Mark Lewison, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much.
How did you get involved with the Beatles professionally to begin with? Because you've been kind of inside for a while.
Professionally? I got into the Beatles in the 1960s when I was a child, and used to cycle around to my newsagents every month and buy the Beatles monthly magazine. Joined the fan club, bought the records or had them bought for me as gifts, you know. But I carried on being interested in reading the available books on the Beatles, such as there were. There were a few of them in the 1970s. And by the end of that decade, when I was old enough to start going into a particular library in London, which had a requirement of minimum age 21, I started to go into that library and do original Beatles research. So that, I suppose, is when it started, about 1979. And I started to... Well, the first thing I found was the date that Lennon met McCartney, which was different in all the books that there were, and none of them, well, possibly none of them were right. Certainly only one of them was right, because they were all different. What I found was that none of them were right. And what I also found in proving that was that when on this subject, or pretty much any subject, you are prepared to go that little bit further to find out the answer to your question, you're quite often the first person to go looking.
How did you find out that correct date?
It really wasn't very difficult at all. John Lennon met Paul McCartney at what we in England call a church fete, a social gathering where there's entertainment for the family and people come along and spend little bits of money on this and that for their amusement or entertainment, and in so doing raise funds for, in this case, the church. And church fates are usually reported in local newspapers. That's what local newspapers cover, you know, those kind of activities. So I went to the local newspaper for the area where Lennon met McCartney, which was a South Liverpool newspaper, Walton, where John Lennon lived. And it was just a case of turning all the pages until I found the fate. They were always in the summer, because the English weather won't really allow it any other time of the year. And I just turned the pages until I eventually found the fate being reported, and a mention of John Lennon's Quarrymen Skiffle Group, even a mention of John Lennon by name. So I knew that was the event at which they played, and quite clearly that was the one where Paul McCartney was present. So I then had the date for the first time. It was different to any other book.
Now, I visited Walton and went to the spot where the fete took place, and there's a little plaque there. Now, does the plaque have the correct date?
The plaque does have the correct date, yes, because after I found it, it became accepted as the date. All that's by the by, other than to say that that's how I started doing this. So I was 21, and right. I carried on, and I did loads of work for several years of work to establish all the Beatles' live appearances, all the stages they'd played in England and Scotland and Wales and Ireland and around the world, including the States, of course. And that led to my first book, which was called The Beatles Live. And when it came out, Paul McCartney said it was the best book on the Beatles he'd ever read, and would I want to do some work for him? So I suppose that was really how I started to get on the inside, through having done the work and through having it recognized.
So Paul McCartney, what, he called you on the phone, or he sent you a note, or what?
His PA phoned me. The second book I wrote was The Beatles Recording Sessions.
Right.
And I interviewed Paul for that twice. And we got along really well. And it probably fed into an idea that he had anyway, which was that he would write his autobiography. He was planning on doing his autobiography. We now know that it never happened.
Or it hasn't happened yet.
It hasn't happened yet. Back in 1987, he was thinking of it. And I had a phone call from his PA to say, would you like to help him do it? So I said, nah, get lost. So, yeah, that was the start of it. I had a contract with Paul to help him write his autobiography. And that contract didn't have an end date on it. So I had it, one of the clauses was that whilst helping him write his book in any way that he might require of me, I would not write a competing book. So actually that was a contract that I voluntarily cancelled at the start of this present project, because I didn't want to fall foul of any contract with Paul McCartney to stop me writing the book which I really do want and need to write, which is this one. No, it was just, I, that's quite nice in a way, because I was obviously greatly thrilled at the prospect of working with Paul McCartney on his autobiography. But it was kind of, if you like, my own life journey that I would come to the point where I would actually want to cancel that.
So now you write about John and Paul's first meeting and about George and Paul meeting. But tell us now, what about the first meeting between Mark Lewisohn and Paul McCartney? What was that like?
It was good. The very first meeting was at a Buddy Holly Week party. Paul used to hold these annual Buddy Holly Weeks in usually in London. And there was a party in 1986, and my first book had just come out, and he went on the radio and said that it was the best Beatle book he had read, and so we met soon after that, and that was very pleasant, but it was just a party meeting. First time I actually sat down to talk to him, or to listen to him talk to me, was May 1987 for the Recording Sessions book, and it was good. I'd severed a tendon in my right hand, and I had my arm in a plaster or in a sling, and he had just done some injury working with cutting down trees, I think, or something like that, in the woods where he lived. So we had this kind of really weird kind of little finger handshake. And we proceeded to get on really well, because I think he appreciates it when people ask him a little questions with a little bit more knowledge and thought than he usually gets when he goes around promoting an album.
Yeah, I mean, listening to Paul McCartney being interviewed over the years, you can always tell when Paul is interested in the interviewer. And
yeah, he's very rarely engaged, fully engaged by the process. He doesn't need to be, because the questions are entirely predictable.
The same ones, always.
Yeah, pretty much. But actually, and therefore the myth has grown that he does his interviews in kind of automated drive.
He tells the same stories a lot.
He does do that a lot, but that doesn't mean that if you really keep an open mind to things, that you won't find great interviews that he's done down the years. And, I mean, I've interviewed him a lot, and they're all full of interesting questions that he doesn't usually get asked, and therefore full of interesting answers he doesn't usually give. And there are many others as well. He has done some outstandingly good interviews down the years, but the perception is that they're all the same. That isn't quite right.
Well, the one that he did in, I think it was around 1980 for Musician magazine, was a very good one.
Yes, that was very good. He also did a very good one with Mike Reed, the BBC disc jockey, in 1987-88. And he did a very good one with a BBC broadcaster called Janice Long, who is from Liverpool, and asked him much more kind of Liverpool-centric questions, and therefore got completely fresh answers.
Yeah.
So there have been many good interviews with Paul down the years. And actually, Paul will often bring to the interview whatever beef he's got about something or other at the moment. So he might have just come out of a business meeting a few days earlier, riled by something, and the next interviewer who asks him a question will get that.
Right. Depending on, it doesn't matter what the question was.
Often not, no. And I enjoy all that, because I'm sitting here listening, thinking, well, you know, something's wound him up here. What is it? And that's part of the story as well, you know. But the whole purpose of this present project, The Beatles All These Years, is to keep a completely open mind. So, though, as I say, there is this perception that Paul doesn't give good value in interviews, that cannot be said across the board. It's just mostly true, but not entirely true.
So, Mark Lewisohn, when you were writing your new book, did you get fresh interviews with Paul for this book?
No, No, I didn't. I asked him and he declined. I asked him back in 2004 when this project was really getting off the blocks, and he declined. They don't get involved in other writers' books, you know. They do a lot. The perception is, again, they do a lot of interviews all the time. But actually, in reality, if you analyze the process of their interviewing, they don't do much anymore in between projects that they want to promote.
Right. They just
so when they have an album out or a tour or a film or whatever it might be, a book, suddenly they're out there promoting it. But otherwise, they don't do stuff, and they generally don't get involved with other writers' books. Not without controlling them, not without having a direct hand in them in some way, steering them.
So that's true with Ringo Starr also?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. But the whole thing about this project is, as I say, it's to press the refresh button and start again. And one of the misconceptions that people can have is that, oh, so-and-so didn't speak to him for this book, so how good can that book be?
Right, right. But that doesn't necessarily mean anything, because the Beatles, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they have stories that they've told for so long that they believe those stories, even though those stories are not necessarily true.
Well, that's part of it. Especially now, being that the age they're at, they're both in their 70s, Paul and Ringo, the memories that they're recalling are far further away now than say, when they were recalling them in an interview in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't need them to have told me these stories to use them. I'll use them from whatever interview they've said them in, and I'll say where it comes from. This is from an interview he did in 1975 with whatever. You know, Ringo did an outstandingly good interview with a Los Angeles broadcaster called Elliot Mintz.
Mm-hmm.
Elliot Mintz is known better for his association with John and Yoko, but he did a great interview with Ringo. And Ringo said things to him that he's never said in any other interview and wouldn't say to me even if I asked him, because it's now so much further away. And he was just in a mood that day for giving, and so he gave. So I'll use that, and I'll just say from the interview with Elliot Mintz, which brings that back into the spotlight, which I'm very happy to do.
Yeah. Well, now that the book is out, have you heard from Paul or Ringo about it?
No, I haven't. It's been out a little while now, and I really don't know if they've even seen it. I dropped one around to Paul's office and wrote an inscription in it saying, I did my best, which is absolutely true. I did my best. Whether he likes it or not, I did my best. But I don't know whether he's looked at it. I would imagine he'll be tempted, but I really couldn't speculate. And Ringo, no, nothing. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. I hope their children read it, or their grandchildren.
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you. Remember, I'll always be true. And then while I'm away, I'll write home every day, and I'll send all my loving to you. I'll pretend that I'm missing the lips I am missing, and hope that my dreams will come true. And then while I'm away, I'll write home every day, and I'll send all my loving to you. All my loving I will send to you. Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you. Remember, I'll always be true. And then while I'm away, I'll write home every day, and I'll send all my loving to you. All my loving I will send to you. All my loving, darling.
We're talking with Mark Lewisohn, and his new book is a biography of the Beatles. It's called All These Years, Volume 1. And it's a long book. It's 900 and something pages. But now I understand that there's a longer version. I didn't get the full version. Why didn't I get the full version, Mark?
Okay, there is a long version. This book is out in two formats. There's a 900-page edition, 900-plus, actually. And there's a 1,728-page edition, which is actually everything I wrote.
Well, I want that one.
Yeah, well, it can be had, but only at the moment with dispatch from the UK. It's not actually been printed or available in America, because my American publishers, Crown, in New York, are undecided about whether or not there's a market for it in America. And I brought it down to 900 and something pages. And you miss nothing by reading that. Everything that needs to be in this story is in that book. It's not like there's so much more in the other one, great revelations that you don't get. But what you do get are more layers, more textures, more context, more quotes, more quips, more anecdotes, more of everything. But it is complete at 944 or whatever the page count is.
Well, let me ask you a few Beatles questions, because you're the guy. You dispute some facts in other Beatles books, such as the date that John and Paul met. Did you dispute anything in the from the 2001 book that Pauline Sutcliffe wrote? She claimed that John had attacked Stuart Sutcliffe, and she claims in this book that this attack, that John kicked Stuart in the head, and that that was the thing that caused Stuart's subsequent death.
Yes.
1961. What do you think about that one?
I was appalled when I read that. I was appalled for several reasons, but firstly, mostly I was appalled because Stuart and John were not around to deny this. With the role of being Stuart's sister, it gave great credence to this suggestion. But my flags were immediately raised, because this was Pauline Sutcliffe's third book about her brother, and it hadn't been in the first one or the second one, and that rang alarm bells big time. She was basically saying that John Lennon had caused Stuart Sutcliffe's death,
right,
by kicking him in the head so viciously that he had a brain hemorrhage a year later.
And of course, that doesn't sound like John Lennon. Did John kick him?
I mean, John was a very, very, very interesting individual in many ways, but the one thing he didn't do was kick people violently in the head, especially not
his best friend.
His best friend, one of his very best friends.
Right.
The great thing is, in this particular instance, since you bring it up, I have the ultimate rebuttal of it. I have someone who stepped forward to completely and utterly dismantle any possibility of such a thing ever happening. And who is it? I've got to say it. Pauline Sutcliffe.
Really?
Before her book, 10 years before that book, I interviewed her. And I actually asked her about this, because actually Albert Goldman was the first one to put that into print.
Right, in his terrible book about John.
Book, yeah. So I asked her to comment on that, and she said there's not a grain of evidence, not a shred of evidence, not a grain of truth. There's absolutely no possibility, no connection. It's hugely unlikely, and it's rather disgraceful that he should say such a thing. We as a family are all appalled, that kind of thing. And I just quoted her verbatim from, in her own words, in my book, in the end note, just to dismantle it.
Something I think you'll understand when I say that something. I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. Oh, please say to me, let me be your man. And please say to me, you let me hold your hand. touch you, I feel happy inside. It's such a feeling that my love,
we're talking with Mark Lewinson and his book, Tune In. It's a fantastic book, by the way. And I'm enjoying just the you know, just reveling in the early days, you know, where I couldn't be there. And I always think, you know, the day that John met Paul was one of the most important days in my life, you know. It had such an impact on me. And I think there are a lot of us who feel the same way. But that's a question I wanted to ask you. Why do you think the Beatles are so great? I mean, I know why I think they're so great, but why do you think they're so great?
I say it at the front of the book, which is that, well, first of all, the music. The music is absolutely everything. If the music wasn't as great as it is, we wouldn't be so interested in them. Because whenever you've gone through, I mean, I don't know about you, but there aren't many days in my life when I don't play a Beatles track. But when I speak to other people about it, they will often tell me that they go, you know, the Beatles are just part of their life, and they play plenty else, and suddenly, you know, they realize it's 3 months or 4 months since they last played a Beatles track. So they play one, and they're back in it again. Because there is that perpetually engaging thing about the music. It still sounds wonderful. It still sounds fresh. It still sounds interesting and challenging and innovative and very influential. So that's the first thing. But beyond that, as I say in the book, the Beatles did so many things that were amazing. For example, marrying cutting-edge originality with immense popularity. Well, you either have immense popularity or you're cutting-edge originals. You're very rarely both at the same time. So how did they do that? I mean, that is just such an extraordinary achievement, and to sustain it over so many years. And the other thing about them that is just breathtaking to me always is that having reached the top, the pinnacle of their profession, having the world's acclaim and riches beyond measure in their bank account, certainly far more than they ever thought they'd earn, they constantly, one time after another, throw away the formula that got them there to try something else. And of course, history will tell us, hindsight will tell us, that every time they did that, they had another runaway success. But they couldn't have known that at the time. At the time, when they go from Rubber Soul to Revolver, they don't know that their audience is going to come with them. But it doesn't matter, because they're going to do it anyway. And the audience does go with them. And then after Revolver, they don't know when they do Pepper that their audience is going to come with them. But it doesn't matter. They're going to do it anyway. And it changes the face of the album in popular music. So this bravery, this constant renewal process is just so unusual. They are, for my money, the greatest artists of any kind in any sphere.
When I say that something, I want to hold your hand, I want to hold your hand, I want to hold your hand. And when I touch you, I feel happy inside. It's such a feeling that my love,
we're talking with Mark Lewinson, and one of the other wonderful things about Tune In is, I don't know what to call your book. Do I call it Tune In? Do I call it All These Years?
I've noticed a confusion about that. Obviously, being that it's three volumes, it has a series title, which is The Beatles All These Years. And then each volume has its own title, and this one is called Tune In.
Tune In also it's got a soundtrack of some of the great rock and roll records, from Lonnie Donegan to Little Richard and Elvis and Gene Vincent and all that stuff. It's so great to hear all that music in my head as I'm reading your book.
Yeah, I mean, I look very thoroughly at all the music that arrived in their lives, and I look at it when it arrived in their lives, because I tell this story as it unfolds as it unfolded in real life. Records arrive in their lives and therefore arrive in this book, all the way through it, and you get a sense of their musical evolution and how the things came along to shape their tastes, if you like. And it all needs to be there. So I end up telling the story of rock and roll, basically, and the story of rhythm and blues and all of that. And, yeah, there was talk at one point of there being a playlist for this book. It hasn't happened, but I wouldn't mind if it did. I mean, I've got it on my own computer anyway, but it would be quite nice to see it as a playlist.
Soundtrack album.
Yeah. Yeah, it would need to be a lot of tracks. There's probably a couple of hundred songs mentioned in this book. But I like looking at where they came from and who was making them, and what, you know, I love the idea that these tracks made in little recording studios in America ended up crossing the Atlantic and having a great bearing on the Beatles, and therefore on all of popular culture, and particularly American popular culture. That journey of a record on a piece of black vinyl is an interesting one.
So the other two volumes that you project, how close are they to being written?
They're not. this one took 10 years, and I don't anticipate that either of the next two taking so long. But having said that, they won't be done in a hurry. I've done about 40% of the research for Volume 2. But I haven't started writing it yet. I've got 2 or 3 years of research still to do before I start writing, and the writing will take probably 3 or 4 years.
So you expect to publish Volume 3 by the time you're 75?
Before then, I hope. But one thing I learned on this project is that every time I make a prediction, it ends up being wrong. This is a very, very big project, and the whole purpose of doing another book on the Beatles is to really, really try to get it absolutely right and to cut no corners and to keep digging for the truth and not stop just because I think I've got enough. You know, if there's more, I need to know it. And therefore, you have to know when to draw the line. Now, I'm aware that I've created a bank of readers out there now who are very keen to read Volume 2. Well, me too, but, you know, this few years, and work hard and get it right. And that, you can't do that overnight.
It won't be long, yeah, 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 yeah.
Mark Lewison, his book is called The Beatles, All These Years, Volume 1. Tune in. Thank you so much for talking about it with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can find us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Mark Lewison. His new book is called The Beatles, All These Years, Volume 1. Tune in. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.